Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz. Ann is away today. America's national parks are a national treasure. They are important not only because they reflect the best of the immense variety of the land and its diversity, but also the stories of the people who have lived here for thousands of years. The national parks are popular. Each year, millions of Americans visit the parks, and many come back more than once to these wonderful places. And they are indeed something to see. From the PBS documentary, The National Parks, America's Best Idea, by Ken Burns, park ranger Shelton Johnson talks about delivering the mail by snowmobile in Yellowstone National Park.
There I was, in the world's first national park. There were bison crossing over the road, 2,000-pound mammals crossing over the road, and it was so cold, it was about 60 below zero. And the bison, as they breathed, their exhalation would seem to crystallize in the air around them. It was one of those moments when you get pulled outside of yourself into the environment around you. And I forgot completely about the mail. All I was thinking of was that a single moment in a place as wild as Yellowstone, or most of the national parks, can last forever.
To help us better understand the challenges facing the Park Service and how these challenges are being met, we have the help of some guests who are quite knowledgeable about the subject today. Our first guest is Rick Smith. Mr. Smith retired in 1994 after a 31-year career with the National Park Service. In that time, he worked in the service's central office in Washington, as well as regional offices in Philadelphia and Santa Fe. He's also worked at Yellowstone, Yosemite, the Grand Canyon, the Everglades, and Carlsbad Caverns. He's the second president of the Association of National Park Rangers, and he's currently the chair of the Coalition of National Park Service Retirees. Rick Smith, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
We're doing fine. After we've developed this subject a bit, we're going to open the phones and take calls, 614-292-8513, or you can send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. Rick, have you had a similar kind of moment in one or more of the parks over the years?
Well, I would guess that almost anyone that's worked for the National Park Service has had one of Ranger Johnson's aha moments. It's just almost impossible to live and work in a national park, or for that matter visit one, without having something so extraordinary happen that it makes you pause and think, wow, what a great idea this was, and how fortunate am I to be here.
Rick, can you tell us a little bit more about the National Park Service and where it sort of fits into the cultural and social landscape of America? We have in our country a lot of recreational and cultural and social attractions, state parks, national forests, the list goes on and on and on. But what, in your view, makes the Park Service system, and the national parks in particular, really special?
Well, first of all, national parks are just that. They're national. They belong to all of us. The state parks in Ohio, for instance, belong to the people of Ohio, and they should be rightfully proud of what they have. The national park system, 393 areas now, represents the very best of our natural and cultural heritage. You know, Ed, it's interesting. Each generation of Americans gets to add, speaking through their elected representatives, the areas to the park system that they believe deserve protection in perpetuity. That's another thing that makes the national parks unique. They're forever. They're not going away. And starting in Yellowstone in 1872, right up to the very last park that was created along the San Francisco docks to commemorate the explosion of a ship that killed many African-American workers at the shipyard. It's a wonderful collection of places.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the Coalition of National Park Service Retirees? That's the group you're the chairman of these days.
Well, the coalition was formed during the Bush administration when many many Park Service people felt that some of the policies and procedures that were being followed by the Bush administration were not appropriate for the long-term health of the National Park System. But it's not a partisan thing. We continue on through President Obama's administration. We advocate tirelessly for the effective management of parks. You know, Ed, it's real easy to get caught up in being efficient. The real goal ought to be effective in the management of parks, and that's what we advocate for. And there are about 800 of us now that have lent our name to the coalition, and it's the first time in the history of the National Park Service, which has been around since 1916, that its retirees have ever felt that it was necessary to join together in a coalition to advocate for sound park management.
What are some of the specific goals of the organization?
Well, we try to work with the National Park Service when we can to be more effective. We try to do what I'm doing now to be spokespeople for the parks, and I don't mean officially, I mean unofficially. I'm an advocate of parks. I make no bones about being one of the park services or the park system's real fans. And I think that that's what most of us have joined up for, is to make sure that we can be a force for effective management of our parks.
Well, to follow up a little bit on that, what then do you folks, or you yourself, think are some of the major positive features of the park system today?
The major positive?
Yeah.
Well, for instance, last year, Yellowstone National Park set a record for visitation. It shows that the American public still is in love with its parks. I think part of that had to do with the Ken Burns film that generated interest in the parks. Part of it has to do with the economy, of course. When you can't go to Europe, why not go to Yosemite? Part of it, I think, is just a continuation of the lifelong love affair that American people have had with their parks. So I think that's positive. Number two, another positive thing is that bills keep getting introduced in Congress that would add areas to the system, which shows that the idea is not dead, that there's life in it yet, that that this generation of Americans wants its say also about what should be added to the park system. You know, Ed, it's amazing when you think about it. It's only in the National Park System that you can go to a place that commemorates the accomplishments of American women. It goes to places that celebrate the accomplishments of American blacks, people of Hispanic origin. It's people where we can see the genius of our American Indian ancestors. It really is 60%, Ed, of the places in the National Park System were set aside for their historical or cultural purposes. We often think of the big Western parks as the National Park System, but that's not the case at all. The National Park System consists of many, many small places scattered across the country that commemorate presidents, that commemorate artists, that commemorate famous people in our history, that commemorate battlefields. It's really an amazing collection of places.
Yeah, I was looking at a book recently and noted that just here in Ohio, there are 9 of those places that I don't know that many people in Ohio may think of this as being one of the places where the National Park Service is all that busy, but it certainly seems that way when you take a look at the shot at the list.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, you know, the only state without an area in of the National Park System is currently Delaware. And I guarantee you that the Delaware delegation is trying to fix that.
Well, every organization also faces challenges of one kind or another. I want to basically bring up the point for at this point, are some of these challenges not so much to do with the organization, the Park Service itself, but just the changing social and cultural patterns of American life as well? Do these
Indeed.
Pose challenges to the service?
Sure. Look at our country is becoming increasingly diverse. I've seen statistics that suggest that, you know, in, I don't know, X number of years, Caucasians will be in the minority in the United States. We have to make sure that the new Americans feel as strongly about our national parks as the older Americans do. And so that's going to be one of our challenges, to make sure that we recognize and welcome the diversity of our people. A second thing that some people have talked about, you may have read something about the book, I think it's called No Child Left Outside. And one young man has reported to have said, why would I want to go out of doors? There's no place to plug in my computer. So we have to make sure that we stay relevant to a younger generation that's growing up with technology that you and I never even dreamed about. And to make sure that a virtual tour of Yellowstone is not, I mean, that's a good thing to do, but it ain't the real thing. And we got to make sure that they understand the difference between the real thing and the virtual tour. The reason why that's important is, of course, all these people grow up to become voters. And voters are the ones that support appropriations. And it's impossible to think that a young generation that's estranged from the outdoors, that's estranged, that doesn't know its national parks, or a new diverse population that doesn't know its national park system, will continue to support the congressional appropriations that provide the needed money for the Park Service's operations.
Okay, we're going to take a break now for about a minute. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz. Ann is away today. We're talking about the national parks. We've been talking with Rick Smith. We'll be back in a minute or so to continue our conversation.
Get the stories behind the headlines every day on All Things Considered.
I think people that live with brain injuries so often feel like people don't understand what they're dealing with.
The Brain Injury Association advocates for various groups working with veterans.
Most of these folks go through way more just one deployment versus we have in our entire life.
On your drive home, listen to award-winning coverage from the WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today with guest host Ed Lentz. 75 degrees currently in downtown Columbus at 1020 this morning. A few clouds today, a chance of rain, and a high of 85. Rain likely tonight. That rain could be heavy, a low of 70 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
All Sides continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
We're back. This is Ed Lentz on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've been talking today about the National Park Service and system, and with Rick Smith of the Coalition of National Park Service Retirees. We're joined in this segment of our program by John Jarvis, the director of the National Park Service. Jonathan Jarvis is a 30-year veteran of the Park Service, and at the time of his appointment by President Obama, was serving as regional director of the Pacific West region of the service. Mr. Jarvis had previously served at Mount Rainier National Park, Craters of the Moon National Monument in Idaho, and the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve in Alaska. Director Jarvis, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Good morning, Ed. It's great to be here.
Well, if our listeners would like to call in with a question or a comment about the National Park Service, their favorite national park, or anything else on our subject, please feel free to do so. 614-292-8513. Or send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. Director Jarvis, what do you consider to be the two or three most important issues facing the Park Service right now at the present time?
Well, I think we have the immediate issue, of course, of the oil spill and its potential effects on the seven units of the National Park System that are found in the Gulf of Mexico. But at the broader scale, I think right at the top of my list are concerns regarding climate change and the effects we're actually seeing on the ground right now in many of our national parks, things like the melting of the glaciers in Glacier National Park, or the more intense fires we're seeing in the Sierras, or the change in the water content of the snowpacks in our mountain parks. All of those are pretty easily attributable to climate change, and they're going to have a profound effect on park resources.
Specifically, what is the overall strategy of the service in trying to come to grips with the challenge posed by climate change?
Well, I think one of them is that the National Park Service areas really provide a refuge, an area for some resilience in the system. And by working sort of at the larger scale, the landscape scale, with our neighbors, whether they be states or other federal land management agencies like the U.S. Forest Service or the BLM, or even private landowners who have ranches or farms, is to provide some connectivity between these landscapes so that species that are being pushed by climate change can have a place to go, and that's part of it. And then the second piece is really public education. There's with our 280 plus million visitors we get each year, it's a great opportunity to talk about climate change and the effects we're seeing on the ground, and also for the Park Service to demonstrate real leadership in sustainable practices. So LEED certification for buildings, biofuels, all those kinds of things. And we can demonstrate real leadership in reducing our carbon footprint and our energy use.
Turning specifically back to the oil spill for a moment, what's your assessment of the situation at the moment? And how do you foresee the Park Service responding to this rather extraordinary challenge?
Well, I've been serving as an incident commander in the Gulf now for over a month in the Mobile sector. That our sector runs from essentially just a little bit east of the mouth of the Mississippi across the state of Alabama, and then the Florida Panhandle, basically the whole northern side of the Gulf of Mexico. And right across the top there is Gulf Islands National Seashore, this extraordinary national park with 150 miles of barrier islands that are receive close to 5 million visitors every year. They're beautiful white sands on the Gulf side, and then on the inland side, estuaries and seagrass beds and critical habitat for things that live in the Gulf, and also a major component to the economy of the Gulf. And right now we've got over 100 National Park Service employees down there, along with hundreds more from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service working diligently to do two things, really. One is to get a baseline of the conditions of the Gulf and our parks so that we can restore it and back to its original condition after this oil spill is contained and cleaned up. That's key, and BP has to pay for every dime of that. And then the second piece is to respond to the cleanup and make sure that all of the oil is cleaned up. And in doing so, it's done in such a manner that we don't cause more impact than the oil itself. So that's really our two roles, and we're down there in force and working very, very hard and having some success.
Let me just ask in passing if the public was interested in providing assistance directly to the Park Service in this effort with regard to the oil spill, what would be your recommendations in the way the public might be helpful?
Well, there's two ways. One is the National Park Foundation, our legislatively established partner, has set up a National Park Disaster Fund. So folks that perhaps can't come down themselves can certainly assist through contributions, and that would be used to assist in restoring the parks upon impact. And the second is for folks that that might want to volunteer, particularly those that live in and around the Gulf states. There is a whole volunteer opportunity organization. Many of them, like our volunteers at Gulf Islands, are doing a beach patrol to alert us so we can respond quickly to oil. We really don't want volunteers handling the oil itself, but they can certainly alert us, and we can get our trained teams on the ground very, very quickly. Same thing spotting oiled birds or other wildlife. And so they can go to the National Park Service website and see about our volunteer program.
Okay. One of the issues that certainly has been in the press somewhat over the course of the last couple of years or so has been the whole matter with regard to the accessibility of firearms within the national parks. That policy has been in place now for some time. Have you any thoughts on just that situation just in general and how it's evolved over the course of the last year or so?
Well, we had the advantage in the passing of that bill, which was signed by the president, that it had a delayed implementation. So we were able to work with all of our parks to get information up on their websites and in handouts and to train our staff on the ground on how to respond and implement this new law. And also to get signing up on the buildings in which federal employees are working, which does prohibit the carrying of firearms, and to get the information out to the public that it's their responsibility to be in compliance with state law, because that's essentially what the law did, is it put state law to control or manage the carrying of firearms in the national parks. And frankly, you know, there have been a couple of rallies of individuals coming to participate in the parks and exercise their new rights to carry. But we really have not had any significant incidents in the national parks with firearms so far. I think it's been a respectful implementation. Our rangers in the field have respected the individual's new rights to carry, and we really haven't had anything of significance that I'm aware of in the parks to date.
Let's just talk now if there are other major issues coming before the Park Service that you'd care to share with us. Just with the public, I think, probably doesn't really fully understand the full range. Mr. Smith was helping us understand the extraordinary variety of the parks and the extraordinary number of sites that are out there. And certainly there are issues that are both, on the one hand, organizational, but on the other are probably just social and cultural as well, as America changes, that the Park Service has to cope with as well.
Absolutely. I think a perfect example of that is, you know, we're coming up on the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, and you know, the Park Service has, you know, all the major Civil War battlefield sites, you know, Gettysburg, Manassas, Antietam, and the like. And for many, many years, these parks were a place to go, obviously, learn about the battles that were there and the men on both sides that died or were wounded or fought with extraordinary bravery. And a lot of the information we provided was about strategy and tactics, and you know who, which general was where he was standing, and this and the like. And it's fascinating information, and people love it. However, you know, there we're beginning to reassess how we talk about these places to spend more time talking about cause. For instance, the issues of slavery, and by talking about those kinds of causes of war. Particularly a civil war, we begin to make these parks more relevant to new Americans. I mean, there are certainly a large number of our population here today of American citizens that our civil war was not in their history, but they may have come from a country where there was civil war. And in many cases, it may have been stimulated by similar kinds of causes. And so in order to ensure that these extraordinary places of sacrifice, such as our Civil War battlefield sites, are relevant to all Americans, we expand the story to talk about a cause. So I think one of the issues that is in front of us is this whole issue that I characterize as relevance, to make sure that all Americans feel some sense of ownership and relevancy to the 392 national park units that we manage. And so, as Rick indicated, I didn't hear him. Rick, you still on?
Yes, I am.
Hi,
good
Rick.
Morning, John.
Hi, Rick. Is to is there is this amazing breadth and depth? I mean, that I think a lot of you know, Americans don't know, and that's one of our jobs, is to use the web, to use social media, to use all kinds of ways to get out and remind the American public of what an extraordinary thing that they own. This Wallace Stegner's America's Best Idea, you know, they reflect us at our best, and they truly do. And I think there's a bit of rediscovery going on right now about these amazing places, whether it is the Statue of Liberty or the Grand Canyon, or the Gateway to the West, or Manzanar. They are all extraordinary places, and they're very affordable. They're safe, they're clean, and they're a lot of fun.
Rick, do you have any thoughts that you'd like to give us with regard to some of the comments the director's been making on some of these specific issues?
Well, I think John's absolutely right that climate change is something that is staring us in the face, and I've been very pleased with the Park Service's establishment of programs for reducing carbon footprints in parks and things like that. And I think having a director whose background is in the natural sciences can only help us cope or set up programs that will help us understand and cope with the changes that undoubtedly are going to occur. I'm pleased that John says that there have been no incidents in the implementation of the new firearms laws in the parks. Our organization opposed that law, but I'm glad to hear that. And my hat's off to the men and women of the National Park Service and the Bureau of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who are down there working on the Gulf Coast. It's a tragedy beyond explanation, and I just hope that they can continue to protect those places which are so special to us.
This is a question really for you, Rick, or John, either one, really. In your view, do you think we need to have more governmental regulation, intervention with regard to the matter of the oil spill? Do you have any thoughts on where we're heading in that direction, just that because of our experience with what we've seen in the Gulf? Thoughts?
You can take that, Rick.
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that either.
Okay.
You know, it's obviously a certain amount of this is the Park Service unfortunately had some experience in Alaska with the Exxon Valdez spill and these kinds of things. So we aren't rank amateurs at it. And I have complete confidence that with the leadership of the incident command team that's down there that that we're doing the right thing.
I think one thing I would add to that is that one of the lessons from Exxon Valdez in Alaska, which I was involved in a little bit, was we really didn't have the baseline of knowledge of what the natural resources were in Prince William Sound and on out that were impacted by the oil spill. And it was a race to get in front of it and establish just even photos of the shoreline before the oil hit. And so in this case, the day I heard that the oil rig was going down and there was the potential for the spill, we dispatched biologists to the field, to the Gulf, to begin that baseline inventory. And fortunately, too, though, over the last 10 years or so, the National Park Service has invested in what we call our vital signs and our inventory and monitoring network, where we've established a lot of baseline conditions in these critical resources. There are seven units in the Gulf, Gulf Islands just being one, but you know, down at the south end, we've got Everglades and Big Cypress and Dry Tortugas. We've got DeSoto and Padre Island and Jean Lafitte, and all of these have critical resources in them, and we have a pretty good baseline there. Now, unfortunately, there's not as well a baseline within the 33 national fish and wildlife refuges in the Gulf, which are critical habitat for so many species. And so I think with any regulatory reform that may come about, I hope that we have the ability to establish those baseline conditions well before we have an oil spill.
And is it fair to assume as well that there are undoubtedly contingency plans of some sort or another should that oil get out of the Gulf and start moving elsewhere?
Yes, we are already, we've stood up a Florida Unified Command in Miami that is monitoring very closely the potential for any of this oil to enter, to exit the Gulf via the loop current and enter the Gulf Stream.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much, Director John Jarvis of the National Park Service, for taking time from your undoubtedly very busy schedule. It must be a very hectic time. We're going to take a break right now for about a minute and then come back and talk some more about the National Park Service and system. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I'm Ed Lentz.
As a second-generation business owner, new father, and musician at night, keeping informed about the world is necessary and difficult. Whether it's Terry Gross at lunch, Bluegrass Ramble on the weekend, or the BBC at night, WOSU is always on my radio. This is Matthew Sullivan, and WOSU is my source for the information I need to be an informed business owner and father, and the entertainment and music I need to unwind my busy brain.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides. In just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program will be here. We'll hear the true story of the Battle of Little Bighorn and the larger-than-life figures of Sitting Bull and George Armstrong Custer with author and historian Nathaniel Philbrick. That begins at 11, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Central Ohio Unitarian Universalist Congregations, taking part in the Pride Parade Saturday, June 19th, and having services Sunday the 20th, to which all are welcome. More information at centralohiou.info.
And it's 75 degrees in downtown Columbus, some sunshine and clouds today. There is a chance of rain, a high of 85. Showers and thunderstorms are likely tonight. We could see some heavy rainfall and a low of 70 degrees. And for Wednesday, mostly cloudy, a chance of morning rain and then sunshine in the afternoon, a high of 85. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
We're back. This is Ed Lentz. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking today about the national parks and the National Park Service. And our guest today is Rick Smith of the Coalition of National Park Service Retirees. Rick, let's just take a second and listen to another cut from friend Ken Burns' documentary on the national parks. Kevin Conway will be reading the words of Theodore Roosevelt that had been written in about 1903 about preserving land for the future.
It is the preservation of the scenery, of the forests, and the wilderness game for the people as a whole. Instead of leaving the enjoyment thereof to be confined to the very rich, it is noteworthy in its essential democracy. One of the best bits of national achievement which our people have to their credit. And our people should see to it that they are preserved for their children and their children's children forever. With their majestic beauty, all unmarred.
Okay, Rick, let's talk a little bit about this whole issue of preserving the land, I suppose. You know, we're becoming an increasingly an urban people, and I think you said a little bit earlier in our program today that one of the issues we have to sort of deal with is how are we going to get a public that increasingly is living in cities and suburbs to go back out to the country?
Well, it is a problem, but I don't think that it's an insurmountable problem. Director Jarvis mentioned the National Park Service's public education program. One Yale historian likened the National Park System to a great university system. Each campus has its own particular specialty, glaciers or tall trees or inventions or whatever it is. But these are places that people can come and learn about who we are as a people and the ties that bind us together. Moreover, I think, I was teaching a course to park rangers in the Dominican Republic one time. And one of the things I used to do is ask the rangers to say why they had become rangers. And, there was sort of the standard ones. Well, I wanted to work outside. I didn't want to live in an office. I did blah, blah, blah. But one guy said something that struck me. He said, I wanted to make sure that my children could see a little bit of the Dominican Republic like it used to be when I grew up. And that's sort of, I think, one of the things that makes families go to places like national parks is what did America used to look like? What was our landscape? Who was it peopled by? These are kinds of questions that are endlessly fascinating, and I think as long as we can keep those kinds of questions at the forefront, and we don't let public lands become the subject of increasingly shrill debate about this, that, or the other thing, I think we're in pretty good shape.
Okay. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz. If you have a thought or a question for us, or just give us a call with your favorite national park, or if you've had a good story or a good memory about visiting one of our parks, give us a call at 614-292-8513, or perhaps drop us an email at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned that you had were talking down in the Dominican Republic. Can you tell us a little bit about the reach of the National Park Service? Has the service been serving then as a model for other park services around the world? Tell us a little bit about sort of the international role. of the National Park Service?
Well, since Yellowstone was the first national park created in the world, some 140, 145 nations, it depends on how the International Union of the Conservation of Nature counts these things, have established protected areas of their own, not always patterned after the United States, because in many places there aren't vast spaces of public land like there were in the United States from which those early parks like Yellowstone and Yosemite and Grand Canyon could be created. But they are protected areas, and the Park Service has an Office of International Park Affairs in Washington, D.C., that spends a lot of time doing one of two things, helping host foreign park or protected area professionals that come to the United States to try to learn a little bit about what it is that we do, and also to avoid committing the mistakes that, that we've made in the past. And second of all, they send National Park Service employees out on consulting assignments when there's an appropriate transfer of technology. Ed, our own organization, the Coalition of National Park Service Retirees, we find an increasing number of retirees that also spend a certain amount of their retiree time in helping other nations manage their protected area systems. For instance, I've worked in every Latin American country except Venezuela since I retired. So its reach is significant, and hopefully we'll do more in the future.
One of the things I think is kind of interesting about the Park Service is it does have an economic impact on the rest of society. I think many people may not understand that or think about it all that much. Can you talk with us a little bit about just the economic importance of the parks?
Well, I guarantee you that the gateway communities, that's what we call the communities that are right around the parks, certainly think about it and are well aware of the economic impact. Let me just give you a real short example, Ed. When I was the superintendent of Carlsbad Caverns back in the late 80s, we had about 800,000 visitors a year. And the AAA's estimated that the typical family of four during those days spent $160 a day on vacation. That's motels, food, souvenirs, recreation, et cetera. If you take 800,000 visitors and divide it by four, that's potentially 200,000 visitors spending $160 a day in the greater Carlsbad area. Now, that's a tremendous economic impact. That's, what, something in the neighborhood of $33 million. And that's different kind of money, too, Ed. It circulates through the community differently because these visitors don't make the same kind of demands on the community for fire protection and police protection and schools and things like that that normal residents do. So that's money that's brought in, left, and when the visitors leave, it stays there. And so that's why, communities like Gatlinburg and outside of Great Smoky Mountains and West Yellowstone outside of Yellowstone and Mariposa outside of Yosemite are so interested in park management decisions that have a potential to affect tourism.
Can you give us a little bit of an idea of what sorts of folks work for the National Park Service? If I was coming out of school or high school or whatever, college, and I was interested in working for the National Park Service, What does it take to become a park ranger these days?
Just well, that's generally. A good question. I'm not quite sure that I'm totally up to date on that since it's been so long. Yeah. But one thing you need to be, you make sure, is you have to have a university degree. That's almost an absolute must. And it should be a university degree that has some relationship to parks. In other words, we hire a lot of historians in our historical parks, so people who are majors in history. We have a protection division in the Park Service, so we do hire some people who have criminal justice backgrounds or something like that. We have a host, as Director Jarvis mentioned, of biologists and botanists and other kinds of natural scientists. You know, we hired some pretty strange we had some pretty strange occupations, like underwater archaeologists, historic architects. I should say historical architects. The architects themselves aren't historic. And so, you know, it's and then you have to get in the waiting line and work through the Office of Personnel Management at the federal level because, you know, the National Park Service employees are civil service employees. And so they are, their hiring is managed by the Office of Personnel Management rules and regulations.
Well, at meetings of the Coalition of National Park Service Retirees, what are some of the subjects that you folks are talking about these days that you see as being important to the future of the service? You've mentioned some. Are there a few others you'd like to share with us today?
Well, we're again, I guess I'll go back to Director Jarvis has mentioned three things that are important in parks. That is to say, accurate fidelity to the law. Number two, in the long-term public interest. And number three, decisions based on the best available sound science. And those are the kinds of things we're pushing for, too. And when we see instances where those are not being followed, or when we see instances where we believe parks are not adhering to those kinds of things, most of us know most of the people in parks. I feel comfortable in calling superintendents and asking them about things like that. We're interested in the whole question of off-road vehicle use in national parks. We've been a party to the long-standing debate about the use of snowmobiles in Yellowstone National Park. There's a similar debate going on regarding the use of off-road vehicles in Cape Hatteras along the beaches where endangered species, birds nest and things like that. So those are the kinds of things that we follow. And we also try to provide, you know, some time ago the Park Service asked us for assistance in finding retirees who had had contracting experience because the Park Service was running short of contracting expertise during the run-up to the stimulus bill and things like that. So those are the kinds of things we try to do.
We should point out in passing as well that the Park Service is not simply limited to the United States, the continental, and just Alaska and Hawaii. There are Service sites elsewhere as well, right?
Yeah, we've got War in the Pacific National Park in Guam. We've got American Memorial Park in Saipan. We've got Virgin Islands National Park and the Virgin Islands. We've got San Juan National Historic Site in Puerto Rico. There's lots of places outside the, and then of course, you know, when you think about outside the boundaries of the lower 48, we've got huge parks in Alaska, and one of them, Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve, is something in the neighborhood, if I remember correctly, of 13 million acres.
Okay.
So, Ed, if you explored a section of land every day, 640 acres, which is a section of land, which would almost be physically impossible.
Right.
It would take you more than 50 years to finish the exploration of Wrangell-St. Elias.
Okay. We have a call coming in. Brad, do you have a thought for us today?
I do. I just got in from Mona Lawn, so I have not heard much of this program, but national parks, I love them. My favorite national park is Glacier National Park in Montana. It's one of the wildest places in the lower 48 states. I've been there 16 times out of the last 19 years, and I live in Ohio. It's about 2,000 miles away from here, and I drive. I love the place. Grand Teton National Park is awesome. Both of those parks, you can see plenty of animals. But what I really wanted to speak to in the context of national parks is the beauty of nature and the value of the exercise of hiking. I used to go to gyms a lot and work out in gyms, but I found that hiking and climbing some of the peaks in some of those national parks that are just walk-ups, that you can get great aerobic exercise, have the chance to see beautiful wildflowers, just carpets of them, chance to see wild animals, and you don't have to pay a gym membership, just an entrance fee. And they're beautiful. I think nature has the power to heal, and it bothers me that our society seems to be going farther and farther in the direction of technology that keeps us inside. We're not getting outside. Our kids aren't getting outside like we used to. And
okay, well, I guess we have. Thank you for your comments today. We're running out of time. I think Brad has the last word. This is Ed Lentz on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My thanks to Rick Smith for talking with us today about the national parks.
Thanks, Ed.